magnetic field. What do you think, Dick?
Before, Dick, before you go with that, there was another video that I have shown also, which shows, and John, you've seen that video as well, let me drop. And that video was the flying coin. The guy took the round magnet that was a smart magnet, magnetized from one side, and he created a self-motion on it. It wasn't really self-motion. I don't have a proper vocabulary in it, but if there is a need for it, I can resend that material. I mean, what is the good for me to prepare something that is interesting? Then a month later we come to that and we say, we didn't see that. No, it doesn't exist, Wesley. Enter it here.
This is 2WGB. Well, Wes, you send a lot of material out. Sometimes a month later it's a little difficult to exactly remember what's going on. But you have to understand, we're watching videos. We're not witnessing. We're not there. So what it's showing in the video, how do we prove it? There's a lot of nebulosity there, I believe. Dick, over to you, sir.
Yeah, we have authority problem. MIT videos are lies. Then, because of the videos are lies. Oh, maybe, you know what, it's just up to the judgment. I mean, we're going to craziness in here for the authority or belief or the proper assignment. Enthusiasm.
We're assembling here a group of interested people, and we're trying to find out where the truth lies. And for the time being, the only thing we've got in our favor, Wes, is majority logic. Glenn has a certain amount of experience. I have a certain amount of experience. John has a certain amount of experience. Wesley has a certain amount of experience. Andy has a certain amount of experience. Eric has a certain amount of experience. We try to use majority rule in that situation because we have no choice. To get back to John's original question, could you generate a spherical object where the North Pole is in the center of the sphere and the South Pole is all of the perimeter of the sphere? Good question. I think the answer is no. Because if every bit of the surface of this small spherical magnet-like thing is going to be, let me pick a number, the North Pole, and the dead center of the sphere is going to be the South Pole, and that everything that Glenn, John, Dick, and Eric is familiar with tells us that the magnetic lines of force must close in complete loops. I can't see any technique by which all of those magnetic lines of force coming directly out of the surface of the sphere, perpendicular to the surface of the sphere, going out into space, can now close themselves and end up in the center of the sphere. I can't envision that happening. As such, I believe that thing that you just described, John, is not possible. Let's see if Glenn thinks it's also not possible. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Real quick, Dick, my point exactly, because if the magnetic field tried to return, how would it penetrate?
Okay, so John's expressed his opinion. Glenn, what do you think? I think that is an impossible structure.
Well, I think, Dick, the units and the dimensions of electromagnetic fields explain it all. In other words, the mere fact that the magnetic lines of flux, that those circular lines that you're describing, are described as a path length. They're not a path area. They're not a path volume. It's a path length. It's a linear length. Now, when you're talking about cross-sectional area, now that's an area. That's a side versus side. But the magnetic path itself is a length. So how can it be three-dimensional? Just doesn't work. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, I do have an explanation for one of the videos that seemed to show a bipolar magnet, a unipolar magnet. Let me stop.
VDH, with a comment?
VDH, we're going to get to you in a second. One of the videos showed a guy doing a magnetization procedure. In other words, he was taking a essentially unmagnetized material that did have high coercivity. In other words, it is capable of being magnetized and maintaining magnetization. He put it into this very large horseshoe-shaped magnetizing structure. However, the gap of the horseshoe magnetizing structure was, let me pick a number, 2 inches. In theory, he could put a 2-inch thick material in there and magnetize it. But the device he was putting in was approximately the size of a nickel, the thickness of a nickel and the diameter of a nickel. Had he put it dead center in the air gap and turned on the magnetization machine, he would have gotten a conventional magnetization from one flat surface being north to the other flat surface being south. He didn't do that. He took the unmagnetized material and slapped it up against one side, one pole of the magnet. So he had a huge air gap on one side and a non-air gap on the other side. He turned on the magnetizing device and did magnetize his nickel-shaped object. Now when he tested magnetization, on the flat side of the nickel that was against the pole piece, he could sense pretty strong magnetic field. On the side that was against the air gap, he sensed a very weak magnetic field. He didn't do the next step. He didn't measure perimeter magnetization. It is possible if he had, if he had homogeneous material that could be capable of being magnetized in any direction, and some materials come pretty close to that. If he had homogeneous magnetization-like material, he could have had a strong north pole on the center of the face that was against the pole piece. Those magnetic lines then flowed into the nickel, rapidly turned toward the perimeter of the nickel. So therefore, the possibility exists that the perimeter of the nickel was south, the center of the flat face that was against the pole piece is north, and now the other side of the nickel, the one that was in the airspace, was essentially unmagnetized. Although that's a very strange, kind of magnetization, that at least is possible, and now you do have the possibility of closed lines on everything coming through that magnetized device. VDH, give us your full call and name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I have a question to you, Dick.
Okay, fine, this is Dick. Name here is John, and the call is WA2VDH. I totally agree with you, Dick, that the one of Maxwell's equations is that divergence of B has got to be zero, and it's essentially saying that over any closed volume, enclosed volume, that the magnetic field in has got to be the same as the magnetic field out, that you can't have anything, any unipolar magnetic charge internal. So I think that idea of having the south pole in the center and the north pole at the perimeter of a sphere would be violated if you took a closed area around the center. It would essentially give you a non-zero result. So go ahead.
What if you crack that sphere in half? What would happen?
First of all, this was not a sphere. It was a nickel-shaped object. And it is possible, in my opinion, that in one of the flat, the center of a flat face could be, let me pick a number, north. The perimeter could be south. The opposite flat face could be essentially unmagnetized. Very non-conventional distribution of magnetic field within that nickel-shaped object, like a coined nickel. But still, I can come up with a whole bunch of lines of force that flow out of the center of the north face. Each of them curves around to the perimeter and closes the loop through that nickel-shaped object. And now, if I put that nickel-shaped object against a chunk of steel, I'll get a hell of a lot more suction on one side than I will on the other side of the nickel, if you know what I mean, because of this weird method of magnetization. Because he put it into a magnetizing tool that was not designed for that object, and he misused the tool. And it's an interesting thing, and it's got certain uses, but it's a very unconventional method of magnetization is my belief. Who wants to make further comments or questions on this? K2RIW in the TechNet.
GB.
Looks here.
John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, so we have the magnetic field on one side, say north. Those lines of force are returning to the outer circumference of the nickel-sized item. So we have a magnetic field that looks sort of like a pincushion or a muffin. That I can believe. That's a great description. And I think you got something there. That's basically what you were describing, right?
Yes, it is. I saw him magnetize it by using the magnetizing machine in the wrong way. Had he used it the right way, he would have either put it in the center of the air gap, but he wouldn't have got as much action, or the right way to do it would be to put it against one of the pole pieces, put another piece of steel to fill up the air gap. If there's no longer any air gap in the magnetizing machine, now you stand a chance of doing conventional magnetization of this nickel-shaped object, with one face being north and the other flat face being south. But because he did this great big air gap, which drastically limited the amount of magnetic field he could create to magnetize the nickel, and it also made a very weird magnetic distribution within the nickel because of that great big air gap. And I'm exaggerating a little bit. It wasn't exactly out to the perimeter. There was a little bit of magnetic field on that other face, but it was nowhere near as strong on one face as the other face because of the way he used the machine. That's my interpretation of what he did, and I vaguely remember he then put this nickel-shaped object against a inclined sheet of steel and let it slide down. In one case, it would show crazy effects compared to the other case, where when he reversed it, when the strongly magnetized face was against the steel, he got one response. When the weakly magnetized face was against the steel that it was sliding down, he got another response. And so, because he got non-symmetry, he was calling it a unipolar magnet. I don't quite agree. That's the way I saw that particular video. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, I have published two materials based on Alexander Kogushev transformer, very much exotic form of putting the core, and then he slides something that was called unipolar magnet, which is one magnetic side, the other one was diamagnetic side. The material is commercial, be made in United States. Now, the guy showed that from the primary there was no drawing, from the secondary there was a drawing of the current. Then when he increased the power, the difference between the primary and the secondary was about 70%. That made a lot of echo in the world. But this is not what I want to talk about. We have half an hour left. I have additional question because we have had a discussion with Glenn. And thank you, Glenn, for your explanation. I was talking about the possibility of insert the membrane in the very much strategic part of the transformer to alter the magnetic flux. By altering the magnetic flux, we can alter the electromagnetic composition of that flux, and by that, the electric part of it. And that's the way of actually trying to kind of play with the back EMF. So let's say I have a membrane that is put, like Glenn said, let's say I have a donut, we cut the core of the donut, try to fit that membrane, and by mechanical vibration of that membrane, I'm simply playing with the magnetic flux of it. That is understandable. Question for Glenn is, how do I do it not with the donut, but how do I do it with the metal core of the transformer, or eventually the ferrite that is used for the transformer? Glenn, back to you.
Well, typically, Wesley, what's happening there is that there are a lot of transformer designs that are used that have air gaps, like a flyback transformer. There's an air gap in the middle. Sometimes the center post of the transformer could be a core opening in a toroid, especially the center gap on an E-core. There's many different geometries of magnetic materials. And as long as you cut the path length, and it's somewhere within that path length, you create an opening or an air gap, you can fill inside that air gap other materials that have different permeabilities. So you might have a piece of ferrite that has a permeability of, let's say, 2,000, and you can put other materials inside, either just use air, a permeability of 1, or go with other materials and put them in between, and or possibly even modulate them. So you can vary it, but the key thing is to put it inside the path length of the transformer. KC2QIQ.
Okay, thank you very much for that. This is what I thought. The structure of Kukushev transformer was very much exotic, and John would be able to say a few words about it, how the cores were made around the coil. And then I would like to go to the subject of that I sent to you. John?
Wesley, I don't remember that construction exactly. I remember discussing it with you where he filled it with different C structures. That's the one you're talking about, right?
Yeah, he had four C structures around each side of the coil, if you can describe it better English.
Dick, what happened with that is he had a core with a coil on it, and he put two C structures, one from each end, so they would meet, and he did that a couple of times around that. That's the magnetic coupling that he was using, or the core coupling that he was using. That's about all I know about it.
Yeah, but then when he closed the other C, of a sudden the primary of the transformer didn't show any drawing of the card. Of the card.
I've got a question for Glenn. Glenn, if I've got a toroidal transformer, toroidal coil, laying flat on the table, and one place around the 360 degrees of the toroid, this donut, there is no winding in one particular area, and with my Dremel tool, I cut a slot. So I've now got an air gap in a little portion of that toroid. And in that air gap, I plug in some very high permeability material, like 1,000 ferrite you were talking about. And now I, with an electromagnet, create a vertical magnetic field through that air gap that's got the high permeability material. So at right angles to that circle, I've got a nickel-shaped size, you know, a coin-shaped sized ferrite high permeability material, and edgewise, so to speak, vertically polarized on this table, I'm creating a strong magnetic field and saturating that sliver of ferrite material. Would that be a method by which I could modulate the inductance of that toroidal coil? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, if the properties of the magnet are being moved in and out of the magnetic path length, the inductance will be modulated, but not by saturation. Because keep in mind what's actually happening. When you put a magnet that has polarity, north and south pole, inside an air gap of a transformer, or an inductor for that matter, what you're basically doing is you're pushing the B field in a polarized direction into one quadrant. So if you were to draw your transformer's BH curve, starting from your positive flux limit to the top, or the saturation point, let's say it's 4,000 Gauss, and as you cross through zero, you're going to have a minus 4,000 Gauss. When you look at the geometry of the magnet that you put in there, and the field of the magnet that you're putting in, you can actually push the saturation point of the magnet of the transformer up into one quadrant. Where is this important? Well, let's say if you had a inductor and you were putting a DC current into it, and you have a material like ferrite that doesn't really, with a closed air gap, in other words, if you have all solid ferrite material, it's going to want to saturate very, very quickly with DC current. So you put an air gap inside there, but the minute you put the air gap in, the inductance drops. Let it drop for a second. Well, what happens now is that when you put the magnet inside, if you put it in the correct north-south direction, depending on the direction of the current flow in the wire, you can actually extend the B field in one direction. So you can actually run higher currents in that one direction and still maintain high inductance without having the permeability of that material roll off. So what you're really doing by putting the magnet in the magnetic path length is you're pushing the saturation point of the transformer much higher in one direction. Does that make any sense, Dick? K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Isn't that how a recording head works, Dick?
Not quite. I didn't make it clear, Glenn. Assume now I've got the sliver of ferrite material in the gap that I've made in this toroid. And ordinarily, the toroid being used as a cyclic sine wave inductor with no DC current, ordinarily the magnetic field of the toroid is flowing through the high permeability ferrite 1000 material, flowing at right angles to its flat, flowing normal to its flat surface. It's got a circular flat surface. It's a sliver of material mounted in that gap, and the normal operation of the toroid pours magnetic field through the ferrite material in a normal direction to its flat surface. While I'm using it as an inductor, at right angles to the normal magnetic flow, I am externally creating a very strong vertical magnetic field. So I'm using the material horizontally in a non-saturated manner. I'm not putting the signal in there too big, but I'm saturating it at right angles. I'm vertically saturating it. I think there's a chance that when the material is saturated vertically across the long dimension of the ferrite material, this circle of ferrite material, I think if I saturate it at right angles, I'm going to see at least partial saturation in the normal direction of the magnetic field of the toroid. See where I'm going with that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, I guess I'm having problems visualizing the model. In other words, right now, in other words, you have this toroid, and I would imagine that you have some kind of a coil around the outside of this toroid. Am I describing it so far? And is there or is there not an air gap in the toroid?
Yes, it's an ordinary donut-shaped toroid. It's laying flat on the table. There's a coil of wire around the perimeter of that toroid. With my Dremel tool, I have cut a slot at the 12 o'clock position in the toroid ferrite material. I've cut a slot at 12 o'clock. I've made the slot, let me pick a number, 10,000ths of an inch wide, all the way through. I've got an air gap of 10,000ths of an inch at the 12 o'clock position. Toroid still laying flat on the table. I pick up, and my toroid, by the way, its cross-sectional diameter is, let me pick a number, half an inch. And make it 1 inch. 1 inch cross-sectional diameter of the toroid material. The whole Don toroid is maybe 4 inches in diameter. It's laying flat on the table. It's got this vertical air gap at the 12 o'clock position. I pick up a chunk of ferrite material. That's a 1 inch diameter nickel. It's got the exact same thickness as the slot. I think I made the slot 10,000ths of an inch. So it's got 10,000ths of an inch of thickness. I pick up this nickel shape, a coin nickel shape of ferrite material. I slip it into the slot. I completely fill up the air gap of the slot. There's no longer an air gap anymore. I put this new high permeability material into the air gap. I'm continuing to use the toroid in the normal manner. I'm feeding the coil a AC signal, and I see normal inductance, a little bit less inductance, or maybe a little bit more inductance, because a part of it became 1,000 material, where the previous material was only 100. So I got a slightly higher inductance. Now with an external magnetic circuit, I'm creating a pure vertical magnetic field at the 12 o'clock position, and I've made that vertically polarized magnetic field so strong that it is beginning to saturate my 1,000 mu ferrite material.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's so strong that it's beginning to saturate the 12 o'clock position slice of vertical 1,000 ferrite material. I'm saturating it vertically. I'm saturating it with a strong external magnetic field at right angles to the way the toroid is applying its magnetic field to my nickel-shaped piece of material. If I saturate the material at right angles to the way it's used, my gut feel is saturation is saturation. If I saturate it in any direction, I'm going to get a change in the magnetic characteristics in the normal direction where the magnetic field flows through the toroid. You see where I'm going on that one? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, but for different reasons. If you were able to somehow saturate the material in a different direction from the directional path length of the core, the two fields will never see each other. I know that's hard to believe, but they won't. But if you were going to saturate it while it's in the path length of the original toroid, the problem is, how do you saturate it? You'd have to put a winding at a right angle to that material, which is going to intersect the path length of that device, which is going to couple and modulate. So, yes, by definition, you're going to have to violate in order to get that piece saturated in the middle of that where you cut your sliver. You're going to have to put a wire at 90 degrees to the path length in order to do that. So, by definition, yes, it would modulate it and saturate it. But there again, you would never have to cut and saturate a piece. You just have to add a piece of wire around the outside. Do the same thing. KC2QIQ.
I put that sliver of material in there because I know it has a very hard saturation phenomenon. And up until I get into any kind of saturation characteristics of the magnetic field, I believe we got a vector summing phenomena here. The normal toroid circumferential magnetic field is, let me call it the X direction of my Cartesian coordinate system. My vertical magnetic field, I'm going to call it the Z direction. And yes, before I do any saturating, I can take the magnetic field of X, I can take the magnetic field of Z, and I can add the two together to find out what is the composite magnetic field in my ferrite material, my sliver of material. But if now I take the Z-axis magnetic field and make it so strong that the material is saturated, so that I can no longer add the X dimension and allow it to add in a vector manner. It is already saturated in Z, and I'm now trying to impress an X. I don't think it's going to have anywhere near the normal response in X. Therefore, it's going to act partially saturated, and I think the toroid is going to go down in inductance when I do that. And the nice thing about doing it this way is that I'm saturating it at right angles. Therefore, there is almost no mixture with my saturating structure versus my signal structure, if you know what I mean. I'm almost keeping them separate. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would have to disagree with that one, Dick. What's going to happen is, if you have coils in one direction in your toroid, so your toroid, the wire's wrapped around one direction, now you've got this sliver that's now extended outside the gap, and you put a right-handed coil around the outside of that sliver, and you start to saturate the outside edge. The magnetic lines the magnetic path length now will be cross-sectional in a different area. So you won't be able to saturate the whole core, only one area of the core. And the part of the core that's actually in the magnetic path length of the toroid probably won't be affected at all, unless it's some kind of like stray field. But the stray field would probably be quite minimal.
Okay, there's a way I can improve this. I've now...
Stop you here with something, because something might be very important here.
Go ahead.
I'm sure you're probably familiar with three-phase transformers, and there's some three-phase transformers that are designed with what they call multiple stacking cores, in other words, where the path lengths are basically shared among center poles. Are you familiar with some of those designs?
I've seen them, and I know that there are places where you have two different magnetic loops that have a point of intersection, and I presume there's vector summing of magnetic fields in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. And basically, to prove the point that I was making before, that the saturation doesn't affect the other two phases, is that it's very, very possible to saturate one phase on that style of transformer and the other two phases are still intact, KC2QIQ, because it's not interfering with the path length of the other magnetic structure.
And by the way, three-phase transformers can sometimes go into a weird oscillatory saturation phenomenon and sing very loud at 400 hertz. I've experienced that. But let me go back to the structure now. At the 12 o'clock position, I've with my Dremel tool, made this vertical slice. Let me make the vertical slice 20 thousandths of an inch wide. The toroid material itself has a cross-section of a one-inch diameter. So the toroid, if I slice the toroid anywhere, I'll see a one-inch diameter material. The whole darn toroid is, let's say, 4 or 5 inches in diameter. At the 12 o'clock position, I've made this 20 thou slice, and I filled it with this saturable high mu material. But now, in order for me to create the Z-axis magnetic field, I'm going to take a second toroid, and I'm going to cut a slot in it 1 inch wide. The second toroid is now not laying flat on the table. It's a vertical toroid. I put the 1 inch diameter, 1 inch slice right over the area where the previous, at the 12 o'clock position, I've got these two toroids at right angles to each other that meeting at the 12 o'clock position. And now as I apply current to the coil of the vertical toroid, I'm creating a pure Z-axis magnetic field at the 12 o'clock position of the original toroid. So I'm now saturating in Z while I'm measuring inductance in X. And because the material, before it saturates, I can take the Z magnetic field and the X magnetic field, sum them together, I'll get some angle between the two by vector summing. But when I saturate in Z using that structure, I don't think it has the ability to respond in X anymore. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, actually it does, Dick. Believe it or not, it will. It will still respond the normal way in the other direction because the two fields don't ever see each other. KC2QIQ.
Fascinating. So I can saturate it in one direction and have no change in performance in the other direction. And now the next step is I start putting angles between the two. I don't make them exactly orthogonal. And I know I'm going to get some interaction. But you're saying Z-axis saturation, completely symmetric Z-axis, because I did it with another 1-inch sliced toroid. Z-axis pure saturation will have no effect on the X-axis saturation. You believe most ferrite materials will behave that way, Glenn. Have you ever seen an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And not only that, you can see its effect on air, on materials, on everything. You can take two materials with two magnetic fields at right angles to each other and intersect them at right angles, and the two magnetic fields don't never see each other. Pretty amazing, isn't it?
In air, which is a non-saturable material, I believe you. In saturable material, particularly if I now choose material that is not homogeneous in X and Z, I'm wondering. You and I could choose a kind of ferrite material where I've got a whole bunch of little splinters of magnetic material so that the mu in X and the mu in Z are two different mus. You and I could make a material like that. And if I saturate it in one of those directions versus the other, you still feel there's going to be zero interaction. Huh. I'm going to think about this one. Back to you for a comment on that, Glenn.
Actually, Dick, it's not that I feel it, it's I know it. Basically, magnetic lines of flux and field are all vector things. In other words, each one has a vector, each one has a right-hand rule. When you go into another direction on the material, it's a completely different field, and the properties are exactly the same in the other direction, and the never two shall never meet. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question, Dick? Yeah, go ahead, John.
Glenn, is that because the magnetic field leaving one pole is only going to return to its companion pole and not anything else?
John, you hit it right on the head. That's exactly it. All magnetic fields, just like electrical circuits, have electrical path lengths, just like a circuit has its basic circuit path. And basically what happens when you put, when you shift the circuit path at 90 degrees, you can put power in a wire at 90 degrees. The two signals never see each other. Same thing with magnetic fields. You shift your magnetic fields 90 degrees from each other, the two never see each other, in, regardless of material or anything.
Excellent. Nick?
Excellent, guys. But we have a few minutes left on it. I have just a need for 2 minutes.
Glenn, in the case of a finite-shaped length bar magnet, not every one of the lines of force leave the flat face of the north end and enter the flat space of the south end. Some of those lines of magnetic force, not very many of them, leave the bar magnet one-third of the way from the left-hand end and re-enter one-third of the way from the right-hand end. So there are places along the bar magnet where there is some non-pure X magnetic field. There really is in that bar magnet a mixture of magnetic fields. As such, the portion that is a mixture, I think I can saturate that portion and therefore modulate some of its characteristics. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, the term you're looking for, Dick, there is called fringe flux. And what basically is happening is that you have a permeability of mu. And the mu is, let's say, like a number you mentioned earlier, let's say it's 100. It means that the focusing force of the path length in that direction is 100. The leakage flux that, or the, I just used the term before, that's the fringe that's coming off, is nowhere near 100. It's like permeability is close to air. It's like 1. So depending on, and as a matter of fact, the mere fact that you said that the material is so close to saturation because it was a very, very high permeability. In other words, generally the higher the permeability of the material, the easier it is to saturate. In other words, if you take low permeability materials, those make very good inductors. High permeability transformers usually make very, very good voltage transformers. And they saturate much more quickly. Saturable reactors even have even higher permeabilities, 10,000, 15,000, because you want them to saturate quickly. So really what you're saying is that that material has its magnetic lines of field very, very well reinforced in that one direction. So the, whatever the fringe is very, very minor by comparison.
Okay, I'm slowly beginning to see it. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, very, very interesting discussion. Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Glenn, for that. I have a few things. Dick, I have sent you the last video link. TK made another show, and that was 4 hours of 2 kilowatts heater. So I've seen it as well. Not connected anywhere. That was two English guys. There was one scientist over there, and there was another guy also present over there, and 4 hours the device worked without any power supply, it looks like, because the battery couldn't hold it. The device was in weight about 3 to 4 kilograms, so the battery couldn't fit in there. So constant 2 kilowatts for 4 hours drawn from the device that was connected only to the aircraft. And to exchange, and then there is another guy, the Iranian guy, but I've sent you all of that information about that Iranian guy as well.
Yeah, that machine that was on a wooden table with a ground lead going outdoors, and it was feeding a claimed 2 kilowatt orange-red heater, when he picked it up off the table and he started aiming the camera at the bottom of it, he had to reset the heater. The heater had some kind of a button on the bottom so that if it falls,
safety switch.
It's got a button on the bottom that if the heater falls over, it automatically turns itself off. But he didn't lift the box high enough to pull on the power cord to lift it. As he lifted up the box, the heater turned off and had to be reset. That's a little bit mysterious. I'm now asking the question, was there a cyclic magnetic field being propagated through that wooden table, that when he picked it up, something changed. At first it would seem like, no, the sparking sounded the same, but they were talking about the sparking changing frequency. I'm having trouble believing that the sparking should change frequency simply because he picked it up. And because he picked it up and put it back down, the push-button switch on the heater had to be reset. A little something peculiar could have been taking place there. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
I hope at once, maybe the guys responsible switching off this repeater at 12, once a week, maybe they give me a chance to talk a little bit on it. It might be interesting to all of it. Anyhow, no, that was not, I was in this house exactly. I also posted the material with the few pictures and photographs that it could not be. This house is very much differently built. No, there was no magnetic field, no nothing at all. And the guy spent $20,000 just to see the show for 4 hours. You know, plenty of notion about it. The government was also involved in it, of England. But anyhow, we don't have a time for it. The guys from Limark switching, rushing to switch off the repeater right now.
Did he say where the energy was coming from to power his device in order to produce 2 kilowatts into that heater for 4 hours? Did he say where the energy was coming from? Just a ground wire connected outside, of course, doesn't seem like an explanation. Back to you, Wes.
Yes, the guys were renting a lot of material, tools, and the list of all of the instruments was posted. So probably about a good $200,000 of the tools, but we have 12 o'clock right now. Now there is another guy, Iranian guy, who said that he's going to release his technology at 6th of September. Entergy.
Did he state where the energy was coming from during the 2 or 4 hours of that 2 kilowatts? While that thing was sitting there sparking, did he say where the energy was coming from? Did he make a claim as to what was doing that?
Yes. He said that the energy comes from the interaction of the device to the ambient air. What he says. And I have made a certain progress in that area, following that concept, and I have been in his house. And I have seen the device working.
Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
This is K6 Delta, Papa Zulu, Mobile in Richmond Hill listening. Is anybody around?
K6 TPZ, K2K, and good morning, Hal.
Good morning, Richard. How's everything doing? I'm just going to grab a little, as they say, grub and a rag, and then wait around for a couple of people that want to bring me some headaches.
That's always a good thing. Everything is good. Can't complain. Great weekend. And that's it. No complaints.
Hey, very good. I had a good weekend too, Richard. In fact, I was able to still check that for about 45 minutes last night. And I don't know, I must have drifted off. I've been very busy, though. One project after another.
I don't know, but I mentioned to you on the on that station scope what I found wrong with it. I forgot if I mentioned to you or not.
You were kind of fading out there, Hal. I missed the last part. Something about if you mentioned something to me.
About the station scope I picked up from you.
No, the heat kit.
Oh. And what about it?
We got it working. We had a couple burn resistors. Luckily, the CRT was okay. And on the other piece, somebody tried to work on the 104. They weren't too clean on what they did.
Yeah, again, I assume that those things came out of a working working station. I think that he had two operating stations. Sometimes, you know, when someone passes away and the family doesn't know what to do with equipment, sometimes on the safe side, they cut cords. I mean, I've seen that happen just because they didn't know any better. So, you know, sometimes hopefully that's all that it is, and other times maybe something did go wrong.
Well, we worked on it. We got it flying. Did you ever find that jumper cable for the VFO with the two Molex connectors on each side?
No, I don't think that, I don't remember getting any cables with anything. I think that everything that we got was attached to whatever it was, so, you know, probably not.
The VFO must have been sitting there then freely with no attachment.
Well, again, you don't know what the family did when, I don't know how long the equipment was sitting before it was picked up. But, you know, if a VFO is attached to something, you know, they may have pulled out some cords themselves and put them together but not given them to the person who picked the equipment up.
Yeah, that's possible, Rick. Well, no, I'll have to make up a cable, no big deal. But I finally got the transceiver working, got the scope working, I threw it up on the inventory shelf, that's all. I went for your crystals for your 220 situation. I was told by International everything was paid up, and I'll be sending them directly to me. You didn't have to do that. I would have taken care of it. You could have straightened it out with me.
Hey, it wasn't a problem. We just figured sometimes it's just easier to pay right out of the club treasury. You know, it kind of happens both ways. But if a bill is coming to the club as tax exempt, which it would be also, you know, should be paid by the tax exempt or resale organization. But you know, it's not a problem. We just you know, it kind of saves on paperwork, I guess.
Okay, well, I'm just concerned about the transmitter crystal. You know, we'll make sure the receiver is fine, but if that transmitter starts bouncing around because of a Bomar crystal from age, there's not much I could do with that after I get everything done. It would have been maybe a wise choice, even though, what's his name, Eric mentioned he has a Peter in the works. But if this thing would have gotten set up both with the transmitting crystal new and, you know, our new receive crystal, then we'd know this would be a good backup repeater if it was needed.
The transmit crystals are relatively new. They should be 2 years or 3 years, I think.
But I didn't pop the unit. Did they use Bomar or did they use International? There's a difference of night and day.
I can't answer that because Andy had ordered them, but that's when Andy changed the multiplication from 18 times 12 to 12 times 18, something like that.
On the transmitter?
Yeah, trying to give it more stability. But the transmit section was was replaced. I just don't remember how many years ago it was. And I don't remember, I don't remember how long it took to get the crystals to let you know the difference in the quality.
Well, if you could pull us the paperwork on it, I'm sure there's documentation. Just let me know. I'd be curious. Because I'm going to run a test on that transmitter, on the chart recorder and everything. If that thing starts dancing around before it's going back up to the site, I suggest you putting in a good transmit crystal and not have to play games with it later.
Well, that's something that you can do before you even get the received crystals back, or you have to wait for the received crystal?
I'm not putting it back on the bench until I have the received crystal. I've got too many other projects, Rick, and this thing, you know, is pro bono, if you get my drift.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll see if Andy remembers, or trying to think whether we would have, I mean, we would have the record of what we paid, but I'll check with Andy later in the day and see. Again, I don't know if the problem was just from using it. I mean, we did use the 220 after it was repaired, and I'm thinking that the fact that the receive crystal had gone bad would really have accounted for the problems that we were having. But hopefully that's it. I think the modifications require some time on the Master 2, and it's in the works, but it's not 1, 2, or 3 in priorities. Getting the 8.5 and the voting system set up is the priority right now.
No, I know what you mean, Rich. See what you can find out about it. I'd just be curious. As long as I put it up here and everything is going to work, I'm not going to worry about it because the receiver is a big problem you have. And I've got my projects lined out for me. I think I told you we're putting the 6-meter along with the 2-meter AM.
I think you did mention that. I just want to check, make sure that, I'm not sure if somebody was trying to come in. Let me let it drop for a second.
Was going to, but I didn't. K2QBV.
And Joel, no, I thought I heard something in the background as Hal was starting his last transition, but good morning to you. Look, it's a lot of different things going on. You know, as you know, you have your priorities, and everybody has their priorities, but it would be good if this 220 will go up and be working well and have a little more time to work on the Master 2. Joel, over to you and pass it on to Hal. This is K2KNB.
And I'm just passing through here. That is what I'm saying. I have a question for Hal. That scope I described, which is right above me here, what's that worth these days? I'm not selling it, but I'm just curious, the yellow one.
Well, it's a triggered sweep scope. I think it's 100 megacycle, if I remember correctly. I have one sitting in the warehouse. I would say no less than $1.50 to $2, because it is a well-built HP scope.
Yeah, I know it's an HP scope. That I figured out. Okay, you guys continue. See you soon, K2QBV.
Joe, a lot has to say is how bright is a CRT? If the intensity is really good, really bright, it's worth more to 2-part. If it's not that bright, then it's worth more to 1.5 part.
Well, I can't turn it on now. Let's say ANUSM 339. That's all it says on. I don't have the book. Oh, it's a 339. USM 339 oscilloscope. I don't have the book here. It's tucked away in my stuff. See you later, K2QBV.
Thank Joel. If you want to check intensity, turn it up to the fastest sweep rate and see how the brightness is there. Not the low sweep rate. Bring the sweep rate all the way up and then bring the intensity up and see if it's nice and bright. That tells you how good the phosphor is in the condition of the scope, too.
I've gone through that. We used to use a P7 phosphor as a medical electronics. That's really enough. We had to replace the scope. P7, it was... should be up there. And I know, just put it across, bring it up. I know. See ya. K2QB is quick.
Okay, pick it up, Richard.
Hal, I'm on a landline. I'll try to get back here to KTKMB.
K6DPC, I'm just going to grab a rag. K6DPZ Mobile is still listening.
Go now, WA2AAE Mobile. How are you this morning?
WA2AAE, K6DPZ, good morning. How's everything going?
It's fine. Just figure I'd head down to the beach and get my walking in. It's nice this morning before it gets too hot later in the day. Enjoy the breeze and the nice weather.
I don't blame you. It should be nice. I'm just going to grab a rat. I got to down and grab a little something to eat and then go back. I got a couple sets I have to try and knock out on the bench.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we grab a light breakfast when we walk. Make something that's not too heavy, but I can't walk without eating. Coffee is not enough. I need something in my stomach. And then I don't know, I've got a couple of things we got to do later on in the day here. Then we got to schlep it to Queens and supposed to visit a cousin of ours, and I don't know. My daughters always have projects for me also that I have to work on when I want some shells hung, so keep me out of trouble and busy.
I appreciate that. Well, you had a private pilot's license, don't you? Did you still have a current?
No, you got me confused with somebody else, not die.
Okay, yeah, your call. I'm just trying to think here. I'm thinking of two things at once. Now, you're building up the collectible old radios. Now it's got back to me.
That is correct. I store old radios, and my wife says I fit right in getting old. But, yeah.